fan of Harris's campaign, the choices she's made. I think she's running an extremely high-risk, dangerous campaign because she is trying to win without the base. You know, and she's sending a message to that base that, sorry, you know, I'm more interested in Liz Cheney and Dick Cheney and getting Republicans than I am interested in listening to Palestinians, to Muslims, to Arabs, to the left generally, to the anti-war forces. She's told us we're irrelevant. And Trump is telling us that he's going to round us up. So this is, nobody would want this election, but we've got to be smart.
Well, you, in fact, just to go back, on Saturday you spoke here in New York on a panel called Beyond the Ballot, The Left in a Time of Polycrisis, and you spoke about Kamala Harris's decision, or the campaign's decision, to focus on joy. So joy in this moment, if you could elaborate why you think that was a problematic choice.
Yeah, well, what I said there is that I think that they were confusing relief with joy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that early sort of cathartic release after Joe Biden finally stepped down and people were, you know, dancing in the streets, they thought that was, you know, a genuine reaction to what Harris represented, when I think it was just like a massive exhale. And that people don't feel joy right now. People are, you know, dealing with very heavy doses of reality, whether it is the genocide in Gaza, whether it's having their towns pummeled by climate events, whether it's not being able to afford the basics of life. And so I don't think it's a coincidence that it's wealthier, you know, well-educated people who are still resonating with Harris, and it's people who are closest to the pain going, what are you talking about? You know, this is not a joyful moment. You've got to earn our joy, right? You know, you mentioned the conspiracies that are happening. You know, this is really a continuation of the COVID sort of infrastructure of disinformation and misinformation that got very, very strong in the COVID lockdowns. A lot of really sort of powerful information pathways were opened up. Once the health, once the public health measures were lifted, there were a lot of people looking for, you know, what's going to be the next liftoff, what's going to be the next issue that's going to get all the clicks that they can monetize and so on. And now climate disasters are really providing that. So it's everything from, you know, climate change itself is presented as a hoax by the Davos elites in order to lock you in your home to eat bugs. But then they have to deal with the fact that people are encountering weather events that are very unnatural. So what's the story for that? It's the government who's manipulating the weather. Why is the government manipulating the weather? Because they want to drown red states. Aren't they responding? Because they don't want people to vote. And also, they've given the money to migrants. So it's sort of a singularity of all the conspiracies. Who else? Who's really behind it? It's the Jews. I mean, it's a whole mess of contradictory conspiracies.
And in this last 30 seconds, Elon Musk and his role right now, the richest man on Earth, saying he'll give $1 million out daily to voters.
That's the real conspiracy, Amy. That's the conspiracy in plain view. And the thing is, about this sort of wild, you know, I call it conspiracy culture because it isn't a theory. What it is a distraction machine. It's a smoke machine that's just keeping us from looking at the conspiracies that we can prove, that investigative journalists have proved, that are out in the open, like Trump saying, give me $1 billion to the oil companies and I'll roll back environmental regulations that will drive more hurricanes to your front door, everyone, right? Or Elon Musk, whose entire business model is just about getting, you know, subsidies from the government and, you know, buying a platform that one man should never have been allowed to own, you know, our information commons. They want us distracted with this nonsense, because if we weren't distracted with that, then that deep sense that something is not well and that we really have deep problems to solve would be directed up at them. So they always have to direct it down. That's also why we have to be concerned about Trump. He will always direct that. He will harness that rage and he will direct it at the most vulnerable.
Naomi Klein, professor of climate justice, University of British Columbia. Her book is just out, Doppelganger, A Trip into the Mirror World. It's in paperback.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
You are tuning into WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. I'm Kate, and on this episode of Forbes Ave, we will be exploring dialectics, or two seemingly opposing ideas that exist at once. I would like to introduce you to our guest today, Jaden Singh, a wonderful fine artist, computer science student at CMU who absolutely makes the most of getting outdoors. Here, we have a lot of questions for you today. Last year, you biked all the way home from Pittsburgh to DC during fall break. Can you tell us a little bit about what that experience was like?
That experience was really awesome, probably one of my favorite memories from last year. And that was even, it's mid-October, of course, so the leaves are going off, and you're biking through southern Pennsylvania and northern Maryland at these elevations where the leaves are just beautiful. You got the rolling mountains in the background and this really beautiful river. It was raining for a good portion of it, and that didn't even detract too much, which I think speaks to how much I enjoyed the trail. It was my first time biking over 15 miles, I think, and it was an 80-mile day, 40 miles, 150 because I had to catch up, and then 70 to take me home. And I think that was a really cool part about it, is I had no idea what was going to happen going into it, got on the trail, figured out, all right, this is pretty cool, and then just went the distance, and yeah, it was really lovely.
So you'd consider yourself a spontaneous person?
I think so. I sometimes surround myself with people who are even more spontaneous that make me think that maybe I'm not. But I think if you ask a lot of people that know me, they'd say so, judging by how I spend my weekends.
Yeah, like I know you mentioned that Wyoming is a second home, and those people from Wyoming are those people that you work in with in the Park Service. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, and that community, I guess it grew a lot last summer because the first two summers I was working there with this youth group, this youth corps that was working in Grand Teton National Park. And so I knew a lot of the kids. I didn't really know so many of the adults, and we were like sort of adjacent to the Park Service, but I didn't get to know too many of the true like professional crew people. But last summer, I was with the adult crew, got to know a lot of people who have worked in the Park Service for a long time, and they taught me a lot. It was my first time spending all my time with people that much older than me, because my crew, my specific crew, I mean, we worked building trails, and they divide, I think, 20 to 25 people into maybe 4 or 5 groups of 4 to 6 people. I had a 6-person crew, and I was the youngest, and I think my boss was 38, and most people who work in trails are mid-20s, late-20s. I think that would be the median. And so that's such a different perspective. They're in a different stage of life, and you get a lot of maturity. But also really the cool thing about trails is with the youth crew and then also with the National Park Service is that you spend so, so much time with them. You live with them for about a month out in the woods, so you'll get to know them whether you want to or not, and you'll be cooking together and cleaning together and having fun together, unless you tuck yourself away in your tent the whole time, but no one does that. Well, no one on my crew really did that. And I think with a youth crew, now that I've known some of those people for 3 years, because I went back and I got to see a couple of them, those are really very important relationships to me. They've helped me out a lot because my first two summers there, I came there knowing no one nowhere to stay a lot of the time. Just no structure. And I mean, they didn't even always have structure, but they knew people and they were always willing to help me. And I really appreciated that. And I still try and keep in touch. And in general, they're also just really interesting people. Mm. Because I'm from DC, and I don't feel like I left home too much coming here to Pittsburgh. And being a student at Carnegie Mellon, it's a similar environment to my high school, which is very academic. Jackson Hole, Wyoming in general, because I've been at this point around most of the state. And a lot of the people there, it's the same thing with the adult crew. It's just a different perspective. and it's a perspective I appreciate a lot. It's sometimes more spontaneous. And yeah, I really do love those people.
Yeah. Do you know, like, would you mind elaborating on what you kind of did during the trails? Did you clean up trails? Did you help rescue people? Or what did that look like? What was like a typical day?
Yeah, a typical day is difficult. But early in the season, I think there was a typical day. But the way it worked is there's a couple different types of things you do. There's basic maintenance. That's what they trusted when I was on the youth crew. We just always did basic maintenance. And that is digging drains. Drains, if you are on a trail, particularly managed by a public land service, so like the Forest Service, the Park Service, and I don't really pay attention. There might be drains in Shenley too. It's just when it rains, you need a way to get water off the trail, because if water stays on the trail, then it'll trench out the trail. If you've been on a couple trails, you've probably seen it happen, and then people walk off the trail. And then basically we want people to stay on the trail, and we want the trail to be nice to walk on. So we dig drains to get the water off the trail. The second thing in basic maintenance, it's very intuitive. It's getting plants that grow onto the trail off the trail. So you just go out there with clippers and maybe a handsaw, take out, in Grand Teton, we target things with woody stems. There's a lot of like smaller weeds, but we can try and brush those all we want. They're going to grow back in maybe a couple weeks. So that isn't much use. With the adult crew, it gets a lot more interesting, because our biggest task early season is log out, because over the winter, particularly early season, there's a lot of thunderstorms, big wind storms. You just get a lot of trees that fall on the trails. And first of all, that's a nuisance for people. Second of all, it's a real big nuisance for people on horses. So we just go out there with one or two chainsaws, and we just basically hike down a trail. You don't know if you're going to see a log. Sometimes you can guess. Like if you're in an area with a fall or a fire recently, those trees are not, they're going to fall over with a really, insubstantial storm. Like it doesn't take much to knock them over. So sometimes you'll go out and you'll be taking out a tree off the trail like every 10 minutes of walking. And sometimes it'll be 1 hour, 2 hours. And those days are really lovely because, especially on some trails, you go out there 10 or 15 miles hiking. You just enjoy the park. Maybe there's three trees. But you take the chainsaw for a walk, basically. It's really fun. And also, you get to run a chainsaw. It's like, I'm pretty new to that. But everyone likes to run a saw. And then just quickly, I guess the final category, which can actually take a huge amount of your time, is you'll get put on a project. So building a bridge, repairing a bridge, fixing up a barn was something I did. There's a lot of just like small culverts, bridges. I think bridges are the main things. And then there's a lot of rock structures. We install rock structures. We repair rock structures. So a lot of dry stone masonry and very like quick and dirty wood carpentry is how I describe it. It's built to work, not to look beautiful most of the time.
Interesting. This is so interesting too, because you're doing a lot of working with your hands. Mm-hmm. How does that compare to, I know you're a computer science student at CMU, so
yeah.
The stereotype is, you know, coding in your basement the whole day. How do you find that balance with this interest going outdoors, and what kind of drew you into this work that you do with the National Park Service and hiking and everything? Was it a response to that, or
I think as far as I balance them, I don't really. From September through April, I'm a computer science and fine art major, and then May through August I'm a trail worker, and those don't intersect so much. And honestly, I always look for ways to bring them together, but at least so far, I'm not quite there. And there are a lot of positions in the National Park Service that involve like geospatial mapping or taking measurements, running studies on in the Tetons, like glaciers, bear populations, wolf populations, elk movement, deer movement, whatever. I mean, there's a lot of things that would involve perhaps computer science skills, but I'm not there. Like trail work has nothing to do with computer science. I was thinking about this over the summer. I actually don't think I touched a computer for 3 months over the summer.
Wow.
With the exception, okay, I did in the office just to sign on for work, like to get my ID card working. I did have to, but those were the office PCs. I don't want to count that. Otherwise, no, I certainly didn't bring one. And in Pittsburgh, I am not a trail worker. I go outside a lot and I do a lot of that stuff. I have my fun outside, but I'm not a trail worker here.
Speaking of enjoying Pittsburgh, you mentioned that you work in trails, but not here. I know you mentioned that you like to do rock climbing. Are there any good spots in Pittsburgh, or when do you find the time to climb?
As far as good spots in Pittsburgh go, in Pittsburgh, I'm mostly a gym climber, so those are indoor. I love Ascend. I go to Ascend Point Breeze quite frequently. For outdoor spots, there's a bridge pillar in Schenley that's interesting climbing. It's really unique because it's a bridge pillar. It's not anything, certainly not anything similar to what I have climbed in Wyoming, which is all granite and like natural fractured rock. The bridge pillar is not that, but it is bolted and it's nice. And there's a couple other spots inside the city that are similar. They're like quarried limestone blocks on old city structures that people are permitted to climb on. As far as finding time goes, it sort of changed. So freshman year, it was almost a priority bar nothing for me that Monday, Wednesday, and then pick one of Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I was going to go to the climbing gym, regardless of my work or whatever. I mean, if something's going to be late, it's going to be late. But last year also, I was more on top of time management than I've been so far this year, which made that work, because this year I've made it less of a priority. And I've also, so last year I only climbed inside. I would go to the gym a lot. I'd also get injured a lot, which kind of sucked. But this year I've been trying to split gym climbing with Schenley, just because I need more outdoor rope climbing experience.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of Pittsburgh, it is more interesting. So Ohio Pile is a place I've been to that has okay climbing. And there's a couple state parks. So Ohio Pile State Park, McConnell's Mill State Park has some, again, like interesting climbing. It's not anything like Wyoming, of course. I mean, Wyoming is glacial, alpine, and this is not. But it doesn't make the climbing any less interesting. It is just different. And then Seneca Rocks is somewhere I want to go to a lot. I was there last weekend. I want to go there a lot this year. It's in West Virginia. It's this spectacular, like, spine of sandstone. It just shoots straight out of a mountain. And it is one of the preeminent outdoor climbing spots in, I mean, certainly this whole area. It would be, you would split it between that, New River Gorge, deeper in West Virginia, and then the Gunks in New York, I think. I mean, unless there's something in Ohio I don't know about. But that area of West Virginia also is just so stunning. It's, you can go there and not climb, have a great time. Or you can go there and climb a lot. And it's an awesome spot.
Would you say that climbing involves a lot of decision-making or using your head, or are you more instinctual with it?
I'd split my answer between the different types. Like in a gym, I'm climbing. In a gym, it's very close to a workout, particularly because I just boulder. Which means it's short routes, not involving a rope, and it's not super cognitive because, of course, so people would argue with a lot of things I might say here. It's, I guess, just not compared to some of the outdoor stuff. It's like the way I look at it is I go in there to get stronger and get better at climbing. That's not how everyone would approach bouldering in a gym, but that's sort of how I think about it. In Wyoming, it's a totally different brand. I guess what I would say, what I do in Wyoming, just to be clear, is not, it's not within, well, what I do is more, it's for the purpose of mountain ascents, which means that you're frequently traveling a lot lighter and faster. I mean, it's not a controlled setting remotely. So a lot of what it ends up being about is a ton of decision making, because you're balancing a lot of different risk factors. And I guess that's the major distinction, is like, here, what I do is not, no risk involved. In Wyoming, I'm climbing. And I'd also want to say that what I climb in Wyoming is not difficult physically or grade-wise from a technical perspective because it is just for the purpose of an ascent. So it's the easiest path to the top is what I'm looking for most of the time, not always, which basically is a lot of risk management because one of the biggest things is storms. Getting caught in a thunderstorm in the Alpine can be pretty harrowing. You want to be wary of rock fall, especially, I mean, compared to a gym, your holds they're going to be there. On a mountain, the rock in the Tetons is pretty good, but I've had a hold flake on me. Kind of sucks. So you have to be wary of that. And there's just also, like, because I'm going light and fast frequently, I don't carry a rope. So it just gets to your head in a different way.
I'm Kate Smiggy, and on this episode of Forbes Av, we will be exploring dialectics with our very special guest, Jaden Singh. Have you ever fallen before from one of the rocks or like from a significant height? Or is that something that worries you, or do you not really have any fear?
It totally worries me. I've fallen on a top rope route, but that's on a rope. I've fallen on a rope before, I guess. That's the first answer. Falling unroped, you can only do so many times. I think I did once in this little crag outside DC, and I fell like 5 feet. In Wyoming, most of the time, if I fall, I would probably die. And yeah, that's in my head, but it's very much something you can get used to. That might surprise people because my first time up a very moderate route on this mountain called the Middle Teton, I mean, essentially a walk up, but I got up there and just the heights started to get to me, sitting on this perfectly secure rock on the top of something. And I was just looking, and you have the awareness maybe that 15 feet at that point, because it really was not very technical, 15 feet one way or another way is this massive drop. But over time, just being in that environment more and more and more, I think you just get more comfortable with it. And that doesn't really mean your decision-making should change because risk is risk. If you're a better climber, of course, that's a factor. But yeah, I'd say it's definitely in my head a lot.
Do you manage these risks also in your fine arts experience? And are you do a lot of interesting paintings of nature when you're making those decisions with your brushwork or just using different colors? Is that applicable from the risk management from climbing, or do you see it as a completely separate entity?
I think completely separate. I don't paint to be super deliberate about it usually, so.
Cool. Do you want to speak a little bit more about painting and just kind of why you feel so compelled to do it? Because I know you've felt compelled to do climbing and computer science, but what drew you into painting and how have you kept it in your life this long? Because I feel like a lot of people kind of give that up as they get older.
This has a pretty happy answer that ties in with other things because I only learned to paint mountains. Same with drawing, mostly. The same way I wanted to climb them, I wanted to paint them. And when I'm painting in my free time, it's still that same thing. So for class, I'll paint other stuff. But yeah, I'd say that it's a pretty simple reasoning there.
In addition to being a great artist and computer science student and experienced outdoorsman, you seem pretty involved on campus. I mean, you talk about your involvement with the tartan and some other things. What draws you into that? Do you take everything to the max when you do it, or is that how you kind of go into things?
Yeah, people have described me that way. But the tartan is because I write sports for the tartan, and I think I've written some news and I've done some other things because, I mean, it's interesting to write about stuff that you think, I find, but I started doing it and still do it because I like to write about sports, particularly the NBA and NFL, which I think, like, during the school year, that's sort of my comfort habit, is putting on an NFL game or an NBA game. NBA is awesome. They got games every single night, mostly after mid-October. I'm still waiting for mid-October. But that's the story with the tartan. I do push for buggy. Honestly, though, these are things, it's funny the way you phrased it, probably things I have not taken to much extremes at all. I've kind of just, it was my, you know, freshman feeler process, seeing what I kind of liked, what I didn't. I mean, you and I did salsa for 3 weeks. That was part of that.
Yeah.
And the tartan also, in particular, I just like hanging around the people. Usually they're very interesting. I mean, it translates to the things they write. They have interesting opinions, but nice group to be around.
What kind of made you want to explore computer science? I know you expressed to me that you had an interest as a kid in that, and kind of what was the driving force behind that fear? Like, oh my God, I got to make a living type thing, or love for it? And then why have you pursued it this far? Because I know you've been talking a lot about nature, but you see it doesn't, like, tie into that. Is your nature, like, going into nature and escape from it?
I don't think I really started getting interested in it until early high school. The first thing that comes to mind was, again, sports, actually, because I think it started with football. I'm the type of sports fan that likes to kind of overanalyze things, like dig up little metrics, little patterns. I mean, you could throw me in the sports analytics crowd, I suppose. I like to build my own metrics sometimes. But basically, I picked up some programming in R.
Data.
Yeah, data science primary language. It probably does other stuff, but I don't know. It happened to be what people liked to use to model the NFL. And I picked it up, and I think what I was trying to do specifically was, I was a big fan, not so much anymore, of the Tennessee Titans back when I was doing this. And I was just, I believe, trying to figure out ways to show that Derrick Henry was messing up the Titans offense and they needed to make Ryan Tannehill pass more. So I had all these splits. I got into, like, because it requires a couple different disciplines within programming, I guess. Like, there's some API stuff. There was some, like, light regression analysis, maybe. Light on both of these, really. I mean, I was picking it up off this, like, random guy from Michigan's YouTube tutorial. And it was, I had a lot of fun doing it. And I'd had some experience programming before, but it was this, like, fundamentals class in C. It wasn't very fun. This was a lot more fun. And you made colorful graphics. So I guess that was a bit more experience. And then I also think later in high school, I decided that I could be pretty good at it and could have a good career in it. And it also, there's a precedent in my family and with myself for studying and researching math. And that's kind of the side of computer science that I thought maybe I could take further. Not so much. I mean, data science is awesome, and I love it. But the theoretical side, which I truly don't know very much about, I think in the future would be something I'm interested in pursuing.
Yeah, that's really cool. What do you think about your classes now? Do they fulfill you in that way? Because I know a lot of the foundations of computer science that first year is a lot of... Or tell us about that.
Sort of. The classes I'm in right now are classes where I don't really know enough about the field to know how helpful they're going to be. To be specific, 213 and 150 for computer science. Both of them are really cool classes. I can say every computer science class I've taken here, I've learned a lot, and I found them quite well structured in terms of content and just interesting to go through. Like, the assignments are engaging. That said, I am not so totally sure where they're going to apply later in my life, partially because I don't know where I'm going to apply myself. So that's where I'm at with that.
Oh, In contrast, what do you think about the art class structures?
Oh, the art class structures.
How does the lack of structure in an art class, do you think that's good or bad? Or has that helped you express yourself more, you think?
The lack of structure. Well, I think part of the reason I am in BXA or why I'm still doing art is because I just wanted to be technically better at it, having not really ever taken technical art classes. So I guess I could have expected classes like risk agency failure and critical studies, which are just mostly or just they are not technical classes, basically.
They're more like theory based.
It's, yeah, theory sort of exercises in thinking about art. So they weren't really, I enjoyed them, particularly risk agency failure. I had a good time in that class, for sure. But I think of them more as like a side piece. Mm-hmm. The studio classes like photography, drawing, painting, those are the ones that I think I came for and I really appreciate more.
What are you photographing now, or what are you painting currently?
What I'm painting right now is solely in my painting class, this uncanny still life. It's the project we're working on now. It's going better than I thought because I am not a very experienced oil painter, and it's an oil painting. And it's probably the first oil painting that is actually kind of turning out how I thought it might. So I'm glad about that. That's what I'm painting right now. Photography-wise, it's, I mean, like painting, or yeah, painting in the past, it's all about place. Our assignment happens to be called, in photography class, a sense of place. So I went out 2 weeks ago. I'll probably go back at some point, maybe this week, to this place called Dead Man's Hollow. It's this city park outside of Pittsburgh. It's a pretty small park. It's got a couple trails running through it. It's surrounding these old factory ruins. I think it was a pipe factory right on the Monongahela River, just outside McKeesport. It's like 15 miles down the bike trail. And there's some really, I mean, it's just pretty graffiti to photograph, partially. It's a beautiful environment to walk around in. I've been there a couple times. Usually I'm just going down the bike trail and it's on the right, and I think, oh, this is a nice place for a water break. Stop there, maybe make a call. Just wander around. There's this cool tunnel, goes out into the river. And it's got this nice little creek, a couple benches, just a really nice hangout spot. That's what I've been photographing. Oh, and I guess last weekend when I was out in West Virginia, I got a couple nice photos. There's this camping spot on top of this sandstone pillar that we were staying at. And we woke up in a cloud Sunday morning, which totally not what I intended, because I was there with a friend and I'd been there a couple times. It's sort of a comfort spot for me and another friend from high school. And I was hoping to show him the view from there, because the view from there is so, so cool. But we got up there after sunset, couldn't see anything. Woke up in a cloud, couldn't see anything. So I couldn't show him, but the formations are really cool. It's cool to just be sleeping up there, I think. And I got some kind of sick photos of the mist.
Yeah. Do you have any advice for people on, I guess, pursuing a lot of different things that might not seem related? Sometimes I think it seems impossible to be able to do things that don't necessarily relate and still enjoy all of them.
Well, honestly, delete social media. See, I'd say that because as part of a general removing distractions, because I think it's kind of just time management. For me, it's time management, because they're all things I love and I want to do all of them, and it just comes down to time. So when I can be undistracted, when I can be focused, is kind of when I can do all these things the best.
Thank you for tuning into WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. I'm Kate Smiggy, and on this episode of Forbes Ave, we will be exploring dialectics, or two seemingly opposed ideas that exist at once, with our very special guest, Jaden Singh. Okay. Jaden, thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for talking today. And tune in. Thank you.
WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. My name's Anthony Cachado, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Well, good morning, everybody. It is that day of the week. It is The Angry Young Man. You'll love to see it. Before we get into the mix of things, just letting you know, per the usual, that everything that you hear on this program today is strictly the views of me, myself, and I, and not necessarily representative of those of WRCT. But we're back. We're live. We're back in the mix of things, and we're just gonna hit on three things today. Unfortunately, 9:30 in the morning is not a very popular time to be talking on the radio. So we're working on it. We're getting some people. We had a nice conversation a couple weeks ago with a author who spoke to us about Project 2025 and had some interesting takes. But, we strive to represent diversity of opinion and positioning here on The Angry Young Man because... We learn best from those we disagree with. You strengthen your ability to be sure in what you believe, know what others believe, and more importantly, you understand how to talk better about what they believe. Because nothing's worse than having your opinion strawmanned. But anyways, we have a little we're doing our usual tripartite little kind of coverage of random things to be aware of out here in the world. Figured I'd start off today with a little look at the state of the race here in Pennsylvania. We've got some very interesting new data to look at. If one would turn their eyes to the 538 ABC model for the presidential election, currently, for the first time, I believe, in quite a bit, modeling a Trump win in the Electoral College, 51-49, down from 52-48, I believe, last week. Looking like the race is tightening much more. Yeah, it looks like the last time that the model predicted a win over Harris was... back in August, where Harris overtook Trump on August 8th, and it just now narrowed back on October 18th. So definitely getting into some very interesting things. 2 weeks out from the election, where we're getting close, and by God, do you know it's election season by the amount of ads you've probably been getting everywhere for that. But allow the angry young man to be a moment of clarity, potentially, to kind of just digest what's been thrown at you every couple seconds. What's going on here, and especially what's going on in Pennsylvania? Pennsylvania has always been an interesting case because if you look back. It's a state that was reliably part of the blue wall. If you look at the presidential election in Pennsylvania, I believe the last time prior to Trump's winning of Pennsylvania in 2016 that you saw a Republican victory was when was it? That's a phenomenal question. I don't believe. Bush lost it. Dole lost it. So did Bush Sr. Last 1988. 1988 was the last time before 2016 that Pennsylvania went to Republicans, a reliably blue state until 2016. And then 2020 reverted back. But Pennsylvania's is knife's edge. I mean, just about anyone with a kind of stake in the game could tell you that if there's any state that is mirroring the national trend, the national state of affairs best, it's Pennsylvania, where there is very little room to wiggle around for both of these major candidates. And it's a statistical tie as far as most are concerned. But what should we take away from this? What should we look at? What are indications and trends we should be aware of as we're looking at the race as it narrows in, as well as some peripheral races where there's been some pretty interesting movement? Listen, the primary thing to keep an awareness of in this election for Pennsylvania is going to be the working class vote. In 2016, obviously, this was a contingent that moved to Trump and bounced back in large enough numbers to Biden in 2020 to be a decisive factor in the election. Because, you know, as much as Pennsylvania has shifted away from a lot of the industrial roots that it has had in the past, there's still a large contingent of people, enough to be a kind of solid voting block to be concerned about, not concerned about, but more so to be aware of while looking at how they're going to vote. Because, you know, 2016, Trump as a kind of labor populist in some ways, working class populist, appeals to them in the same way that Biden was able to kind of as the union man be the kind of candidate of appeal in that election. So you have kind of two ways that slices. But in a Trump election, the only way that a Democrat's able to really kind of lock down a state in the Rust Belt is by being a Joe Biden, by being someone that labor is very cozy with, is comfortable with, that unions will feel that this person is going to be an accurate representation of their needs in federal policy. You know, this is something that Biden was. I mean, most would describe him as, and I think it'd be accurate to call him one of the most pro-labor presidents, or at least pro-union presidents that has been in the White House. But at the same time, you know, there was a lot of labor affinity for Trump. I think it'd be seen by there being union leaders who have kind of cozied up to Trump. And then, you know, what does this all mean looking at now? The interesting thing to think about is how there's been kind of a lack of sheer enthusiasm on the part of labor, organized labor, for Kamala Harris. Declining to endorse a candidate, I believe, by the Teamsters, I think it was. Forgive me if I'm wrong. Where they traditionally endorsed a Democrat pretty much every cycle. That alongside a very surprising contingent of union members who have kind of stated their affinity for Trump. Makes it look like labor is not as secure of a demographic for Harris, or at least the white working class vote is not as locked down for Harris as it was for Biden, which should be a point of concern for the Harris campaign, I think. That's going to be what makes or breaks Pennsylvania, and as far as I'm concerned right now, she just doesn't have it, and I think that's going to cost her the state, and I think that's going to cost her the race. But if you look kind of peripheral to that, you have some indicating signs that this will be a Republican-leaning statewide, particularly when looking at now the Pennsylvania Senate race, where two polls now have Dave McCormick leading incumbent Senator Bob Casey. Both Atlas Intel and the Trafalgar Group have him with a very narrow lead, but this is huge for Dave McCormick, considering the fact that he had been trailing for most of the election, and just very recently getting some tied results in polls. But now pulling ahead, this kind of movement, the momentum, the big mo for the McCormick campaign, can be seen by the fact that Cook Political Report has officially moved the Pennsylvania Senate race alongside the Wisconsin Senate race, which I don't think should be discarded. But, you know, obviously as Pennsylvanians here, we're going to, you know, take a second to look particularly at what's going on in our own backyard. That is not just something I'd consider to be a one-off. Oh, you know, they want to kind of make it look good in these last couple weeks. I think that's a genuine significant movement towards McCormick. I think that you're seeing a lot of people starting to see through Bob Casey, starting to ask questions about Bob Casey. I think it bodes well, and it means that there really is, where it seemed like the task of tackling an incumbent like Casey would prove to just be an exercise in how much could we make, how much could McCormick pull away from Casey? How narrow could he get that lead? Now the question's not necessarily going to be so much by how much will Casey be able to win, but will Casey win? Will Casey be able to stave off the momentum that McCormick has built up through this campaign, reaching out to dissatisfied voters, reaching out to constituencies who have felt left behind by Casey or the Democratic Party? Remains to be seen, but it's a definite, I'd say, sign of the kind of swing of this race right now as we kind of get down to the wire, and makes for some interesting considerations as we get close to the end here. Definitely some other things worth looking at. I mean, there are some key House races that are still getting down to the wire, especially in New York, my home area. We got a couple races that are really, really tight, but House control, still definitely up in the air. Senate control is going to be a matter of how much Republicans win by, and of course then the presidency is also very narrow. But you're looking at the potential of either at best case scenario for Democrats, House majority, presidency, and a maybe weak majority for Republicans. Republicans' best case scenario, though, they're looking at the potential of the presidency maintaining a majority in the House and having a comfortable Senate margin. That's a trifecta. And I don't think we have an idea necessarily of where a Republican trifecta is going to go just yet. It'll be interesting to see what policies they pursue. I definitely have my laundry list of things I'd like to see out of a Republican trifecta. But, leave it to the GOP to, not. But, that being said, we're going to kind of pivot away from the state of the race. It's definitely going to be a lot more to talk about, I think, next week, a week before Election Day. I think we'll take a good segment of time to talk about that, maybe pull in somebody in the fields with a bit more of a read on that, for the sake of keeping it fun, keeping it interesting. But while we move out of this, making a plan to vote is important. If you have not planned out how you're going to vote, I would say that it's important. I cannot tell you to do it, but I will say it is quite important. But as we pivot away, moving to my favorite, wonderful, amazing success story, the gift that just keeps on giving, we consistently are getting proof out of Argentina that limited government works, that liberty works. It's a beautiful thing. I got to say, it consistently makes me happy, and it quite frankly makes me jealous, especially as yesterday President Javier Milei did away with their IRS. Yes, they got rid of, they called it the Administración Federal de Ingresos Públicos. That was their Federal Administration of Public Income, which was, like most Argentine government administrations, overstaffed and bloated with high salaries. And not to say that they completely got rid of tax collecting agencies. They reestablished something else, the Agencia de Recaudación y Control Aduanero. There we go. It's a little too early for me to go but we made it happen. So they have a new agency. It's smaller, does the same thing, but more efficiently, with less costs. And isn't that a beautiful thing? You know, it's, you know, they always say, you know, where are you going to find money to cut when you look at the United States government? Just look at Argentina. They're finding a way. And oh boy, are they finding a way to find places to cut. And not only are they spending less, but the way that they're reorganizing it is efficient. It works well. It's streamlined. You know, even if you're skeptical of the idea of spending less on government agencies, you want something that runs efficiently. You want government to do its job, do it well. And, you know, I don't see why you wouldn't want to do it on the least cost possible. But, they are now looking at a reduction of 34% from current staffing levels. So that, it says, looks like here, a general annual savings of 6.4 billion pesos from this reduction here. That, I gotta say, is a beautiful, beautiful thing to see. And it makes you think, you know, while Argentina's out here cutting down on bureaucracy, cutting down on spending, making it more affordable, for bringing the tax burden down and making it more efficient, we're over here in the United States increasing the amount of IRS agents, making our tax code more complicated, increasing the tax burden, spending more and more, and getting no efficiency out of it. And it makes you think, why would we even do that in the first place? And you'd be smart to ask that. Why are we even doing that in the first place? I couldn't tell you. Yeah, you'd figure that, you know, it's supposed to be a grouping of very educated, the best of the best, the cream of the crop that are making these decisions. But it doesn't take a genius to see that there are some relatively unintelligent decisions being made in the federal government, which is why I'm quite happy that we've gone about taking away from the bureaucratic structure of our country. Definitely props to the Supreme Court for getting rid of Chevron deference. Now, I don't know if I got around to talking about this particular case last season of The Angry Young Man. I'll do a quick run over, but Chevron deference basically meaning that there is a deferred responsibility to these three-letter agencies to write their own regulations and pretty much legislate without the authority vested in officials that you usually get from an elected representative. They're legislating with no accountability, which was a problem. You know, Congress was delegating its responsibility to write the laws to unelected bureaucrats, which was a problem. And we got rid of that. Hopefully, we'll see Congress actually trying to do its job and legislate. And hopefully in the process, they'll read the bills and they will realize what they've been asked to put to floor vote and vote on, and why it may not be the best thing for them to potentially pursue. Now, we have one other topic for today, but before we get into that, I think it'd be worth letting you know that nearly 17 million kids in America struggle with hunger. That's one out of every five children who may not know what their next meal is or where it's coming from. At the same time, there are billions of pounds of surplus food in the U.S. that go to waste every year. With your help, the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks can help fill the fridges of children and families who need it most. Feeding America is a nationwide network of local food banks, together sourcing and distributing more than 3 billion meals to people in need. Visit feedingamerica.org today to find your local food bank and learn how you can help solve child hunger. That's feedingamerica.org. Because together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're Feeding America. A public service announcement brought to you by Feeding America and WRCT. Música. Now, last week was the famous annual Al Smith dinner hosted by the Catholic Church, Archdiocese of New York, out that way. And it is traditionally the it is traditionally something that presidential candidates from both parties will do. They will show up to that event and they will, you know, like poke light fun at themselves, at each other, and you know, it's a good spirited thing in the spirit of charity, raising money, doing good things, what the Catholic Church has always been known for, and also to pay homage to the contributions of Catholic Americans. This year, for the first time since Walter Mondale in 1984, because quite frankly, I think he already knew it was a losing gambit to get in the first place, why campaign? But for the precise reason of campaigning, Kamala Harris decided to stiff this event and instead send a rather, I don't even know what to call the video she sent in. Definitely was not, there's not a modicum of respect, I think, put towards Catholic Americans in that whatever she did. I don't even know what to call it. Give it a watch if you can. It's interesting. But to not show up to that event in of itself says something. It's concerning to me the ways in which even if it's not explicit, there's a kind of problem stemming from this. So a major candidate for a major party decides to just snub Catholics. You know, like, I'm not going to your event. Quite frankly, it seems like she doesn't care to know what you think about that, to know what your policy concerns are, to represent you. And that's definitely, you know, even if there's points on which the Democratic platform conflicts with Catholicism, I think it's concerning at the very least to say that if there's a quarter of the country that is, you know, looking to be represented and you just flat out ignore them, there's a lot to be said about that. And, you know, I think it sets the greater tone of conversation. I've been surprised to see just how much bubbling under the surface anti-Catholicism is still present in general discourse. I mean, you know, we've been haunted by a lot of the prejudices present in our society. I mean, there's definitely, you know, many plagues of prejudice present in our public discourse. You know, we've definitely, especially in Pittsburgh, had to deal with the plague of anti-Semitism, which has become violent. You know, just general anti a lot of group sentiment, but you know, it definitely to a lesser degree, but surprisingly, nevertheless, present is this anti-Catholicism in society. You know, a general attitude against the church or the people that are a part of it. And when I say anti-Catholicism, there's I found that, you know, like the second that you bring up a concern about how Catholics are being represented in political discourse, people are very quick to bring up unsavory things that have happened in certain archdioceses. There's, you know, like I found in my own discussion, like I've mentioned my dissatisfaction with the vice president skipping out on the event. And then as a response, somehow it's a valid response to say, well, oh, look at the church you're defending. And then, you know, like, you know, and they're like, oh, you know, you support pedophiles and groomers, and it's disgusting stuff. You know, it's, and for the most part, you know, you see this stuff online, not so much in you see it in some conversations, but it's concerning to see that there's, you know, and it's always been the case that online conversation, you have a mask to hide behind, and you can get away with it, but it's a smear that I thought that we were past as a general American society, which unfortunately we're not. Apparently so. But what can you do? That's a good question. What can you do? You can, you know, if you're a Catholic, you can try your best to just kill them with kindness, represent your faith well. You know, don't let them strawman you. And if you're not Catholic, you know, today, any degree or form of prejudice, always a good thing to stand against. I think that's just a general rule of thumb. I don't think that's a bad thing. But anyways, that's just a, you know, little anecdote from this last week, little point of frustration. You know, would it really be the angry young man if we didn't kind of go on little tangential coverage of whatever is lurking in the dark underbelly of society known as social media? But you know, let's, you know, we'll kind of wrap it up on a better note. I mean, listen, as we get closer to November 5th, things are going to get intense. I think there are a lot of people with very heated emotions that are kind of tied into what's going on in this election. There's a lot to consider. There's a lot to, there's a lot that you can be angry about. But, and this is a reminder I'll share going into the election and just generally, never let that overcome the fact that at the end of the day, most people just want what's best for our country. Most people want to see our country thrive, to, you know, just, and most people just even want to just be left alone. And that's okay. That's a good thing. But in the midst of all the mudslinging and the bad feelings and whatever might come up, step back and don't be angry. You know, just recognize that there's a person that you're talking to, not just the ideas. Because as important as it is for us to kind of hash out these things, and, you know, yes, you know, like there's value in debating things and pushing back, but that's how we grow too. We learn from each other. We learn from people we disagree with. And that's something I said at the beginning of the show today. And I think it rings true. And I mean, it's also the spirit of this program when we have people on is, you know, to speak, even if we disagree, and to learn. Because you might have a place where you overlap. And for the most part, we have similar goals. We want to see similar things. So, you know, bear that in mind as we get closer to this election, what many are calling the most consequential of your life. And maybe it is, or maybe it isn't. Who knows? That's for you to decide. But I'd like to thank you all for joining me today on The Angry Young Man. If you ever have any questions, you know, you feel free to call me after the show. I'd be happy to have a little post-game chat. You can call 412-268-9728. Again, 412-268-9728. Not valid on Thursday because this is going to be re-aired. Unfortunately, I can't talk to you live then, but if you want to talk to me on Tuesday, go for it. I'm around. But we're gonna leave it on this. Let you enjoy the rest of. If you ever wondered, we've always been listening to Stoneflower by Antonio Carlos Jobim in the back of these shows. But anyways, thank you for joining. Take care, and God bless. Rise above!
Avenger. You are listening to the music of the gods with Sean Watson on WRCT, Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Behold the hammer!
That good.